This isn't fly. This is folly.
With style.
Strange little man.
Welcome to the sixth episode of Falling with Style. I'm Doug.
And I'm Derek.
And this is an ongoing Pixar movie marathon podcast. Each episode is dedicated to exactly one movie in the Pixar Animation Studios canon. Today we are talking about The Incredibles, Pixar's sixth film and its first to feature an entirely human cast. The Incredibles was developed, written, and directed by Brad Bird, Pixar's first director brought in from the outside. Ooh. And it was released widely on November 5th, 2004, about a year and a half after Finding Nemo. And prior to this conversation, Doug's seen it maybe a dozen times. And Derek, you've seen it?
I saw it once years after it came out. I think this was the first time I've seen it since then.
Wow, okay. I'm actually a little surprised by that one. Just based on, like, Incredibles' reputation.
Me too, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and based on the fact that I feel like you bring up Brad Bird more than I bring up Brad Bird.
Yeah.
But I think that's for a very specific reason. This is one of the few earlier Pixar movies I actually saw in theaters. I think maybe in high school I must have been seeing them in theaters with probably the same friend. Like, I'm trying to, like... really sure. Dive deep into my memory. And it must have been a thing that we did, was to see Pixar movies or something. But one of the few that I saw in theaters, and I think a good one to have done so with.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Well, I mean, the production people, it's not a lot to get into. Because as I mentioned, developed by Brad Bird, written by Brad Bird, directed by Brad Bird, which is super uncharacteristic for Pixar, but makes sense in context, given... the movies they'd put out so far, and the sort of worry of an identity crisis that any studio is going to face after, what, five successful films? So mixing it up, shaking things up, and ensuring that you're not becoming too insular, I think makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense that they would take a chance on somebody who wasn't part of their culture at this point in their history.
Yeah. I mean, they have the ability to do it. Like, if it failed, like, if this was a experiment that failed, they still have a lot of successful films under their belt, and I think that they would still have enough cred that the next one that they did would be able to bounce back from it. Obviously, that's not what happened, but it makes sense.
Yeah, I think they probably at this point felt like, I don't know how they felt, but I think the reality is that the cushion was finally there. I know, like, Monsters was one of their big sort of, like, can we do it moments? And yeah. Andrew Stanton felt an incredible amount of pressure on Finding Nemo to, like, not screw it up. And neither one of them screwed it up. So I think the cushion was there, even if they didn't quite believe it yet.
Yeah.
Now, I'm assuming that you are familiar with Brad Bird through The Simpsons, right?
The Simpsons and also The Iron Giant.
Yeah.
Those are the two things. It's funny. It's like Brad Bird is somebody that I'm really fascinated in, like, as a person and as a creator. But then, like, when I look at his filmography, it's like, oh, I've only seen, like, two of his movies that he's made, and then a bunch of The Simpsons. So it's, like, weird that – which is weird. And I want to amend that, because even, like, his Mission Impossible movie, like, I'm interested in seeing and everything. Like, I just haven't.
Mm-hmm.
But I also just think I love The Iron Giant and The Simpsons both so much that – just by, like, diving into the creation of those two projects, obviously Brad Bird is a major part of both of them. So, like, I just got to know him so much through those things that it's like, okay, I get the guy, despite having such, like, limited experience actually seeing the things that he's made, weirdly.
Yeah, I know Brad Bird specifically because he did The Incredibles, and then, you know things he did outside of that from that starting point. You know what I mean? Like, this would have been my introduction to him.
Yeah.
I don't know that much about him. I probably know more about him now just having gone back and read some interviews and stuff for this than I ever did before. I don't think I have much of an opinion on him yet, because he's kind of a fascinating person to listen to and read about.
Yeah.
Especially 20 years ago, you know, because that's typically where I go when I look at these types of things, is like, I want to know what you were saying about it when you were making it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he's the same person as 20 years ago. I don't know who Among Us is, but a lot of the stuff he talks about is fascinating. And I don't know. I never know where it sits with me, because sometimes I'm like, right on, Brad Bird. And then yep. other times I'm like, what are you talking about?
Same.
Like, you know what
here.
I mean?
Same. He's, I think that's the thing. Because that's
a very
what
heady
I,
guy.
Yeah. And I think I want to make clear that, like, I'm fascinated by him and interested in him and, like, the work that he puts out and the types of, like, ways that he does things.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that he's, like, a hero of mine or anything like that. Because there's some things that he said that yeah. I'm just like, I fundamentally disagree with you. Or I think you're maybe yeah. up your own ass a little bit. But you put out good things, like quality stuff. That
yeah.
is always really interesting to talk about. So, like, that yeah. makes him fascinating enough to keep my eye on, you know?
Totally. I think I'm right there with you. Having only scratched the surface and acknowledging I've only really scratched the surface of, like, who Brad Bird is, like, philosophically.
Yeah.
I'm sort of like, yeah, I think I'm in the same ballpark pretty much. Where
yeah.
I'm like, okay. But then other times I'm just like, hell yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just and I don't know. He puts out such good things. So maybe he's just one of those people where it's like, I don't know. Maybe I just like the things you do and that's where it is, you know? Like, he knows what he's doing.
I think it is reflected in his work, though, because the stuff, I mean, of, like, the two movies that I've seen that he's done. So, The Iron Giant and The Incredibles, I feel like, are probably, like, the two most important things that he has done, probably, like, for if you're looking at him as a creator, I'd imagine. Like, obviously, his later stuff is important, and maybe I'll have a whole... Maybe I'll flip everything I ever think about him after seeing, like, Ratatouille or Tomorrowland or whatever.
Oh, I forgot about Tomorrowland. I'll have to see that.
I really want to, because I've heard, like, both good and bad things about it.
Sure.
But everything that I've heard about the stuff that I haven't seen and everything that I have seen that he had, like, a major hand in.
Yeah.
In the writing of, at least, in addition to the animation, I think it's reflected how complicated he is as a person in his works, because his works are also things that are pretty complicated. Like, I think that there's a lot of discourse about The Incredibles, both good and bad, because it is like a surprisingly nuanced movie that isn't terribly straightforward with a lot of stuff. I think The Iron Giant is kind of the same way, maybe to a lesser extent, but... It's just all of his stuff is always sort of like you can sort of take different sides and different perspectives on it because he himself is not someone who's a very like straightforward or like narrow-minded thinker. He just has like a lot of stuff going on in his head. And so like the stuff that he makes just always has a lot of stuff going on. And I think that that's like a testament to how interesting they all are. And I think that that's cool. That's why I'm so fascinated by all the stuff he makes.
But you know what's so funny about him is that I can find and have found numerous quotes of him reacting to the discourse about the things that he makes,
mm-hmm.
being like, that seems a little silly, but I'm glad people are talking about it, I suppose.
Right.
And I'm like, what did you set out to do then if
exactly.
you didn't think? Like, it's so funny. So, like, for example, since we've already brought up The Incredibles and The Iron Giant, I didn't dig deeper into these because it's not what I was looking for, but apparently there was plenty of commentary about The Iron Giant being, like, a very philosophically left-leaning movie, and The Incredibles, by some folks, being, like, a philosophically right-leaning movie, and in
yeah.
both cases, he was like, both of those things are ridiculous. Everybody's thinking too hard about this. Like, I made a movie about superheroes and a midlife crisis. And it's like, yeah, but you put it out there and people are seeing these things. So, like, it's just so funny because it's like you made a really, like you said, a really nuanced, layered movie. And he almost seems surprised that he did it sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't be surprised. You know what you did.
I think that that's really, I think that's one of the things that fascinates me so much about him. Yeah, because, like, I know there was one quote where it's talking about, the political biases in both of those movies. And he's like, I'm a true mm-hmm. centrist. And it's like,
oh, well, I saw that same quote. And I was like, I'm glad this is from 20 years ago.
Right, yeah, because that does not really mean the same thing now. And I don't really know
right.
if you recognize, okay, yeah, but whatever. But I sort of see what he's trying to get at, where he's like,
right.
I'm not making I'm not making a specific political statement or anything, but the thing is, it's like you can, the fact that you can do those readings in his movies and you can like pull out very specific stuff, like when I was watching The Incredibles this time, long list of just direct quotes that it's like, that just sounds like it's right out of Atlas Shrugged, but okay, I guess you...
Which he's acknowledged people have talked about and been like, stop, everybody.
Right.
It's like, well, multiple people aren't going to do it if it's not there. And I think I get the feeling that he thinks he's making apolitical art, but you can't do that. You might be making art that you aren't setting out to be political, but that doesn't make it apolitical.
it's interesting. I mean, and I would sort of rather hint the sort of like he just has a lot going on in his head that sort of subconsciously comes out in his work that he doesn't realize. Sure. I would rather that than like actually trying to make like propaganda for one side or another. You know what I mean? Like I don't know. Sometimes like Zack Snyder kind of freaks me out with how like up Rand's ass he tends to be. Like, sure. And then it's just like pulls back a little bit, but then it's like, but I also kind of want to do a Fountainhead movie. But it's like, okay, come on.
That's not a mistake, sir.
Right. Exactly. So, but I do think it's interesting. I think that's the thing that makes Brad Bird interesting, because I think there's artists can always be interesting, because I do think it is really easy for artists who are very good at what they do to just not realize how much of themselves they're putting into the work that they're creating, especially when it's like a medium that is really collaborative and has other voices. And so maybe they just don't realize, like, they don't realize how much of themselves actually is in there when they're working with other people, maybe.
Or when they can point to one specific thing they know they put into it. Like in this case, Brad Bird can identify his own inspiration for what this movie is, and that could be narrowing his vision, right? So, like, if he specifically, as the creator of this movie, sees it as a movie about family struggle and midlife crisis and, like, feeling confined, that might just be what he hammers home and doesn't really acknowledge or want to recognize the other things about himself or the world he's living in that ended up making its way in there subconsciously.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, whenever you sort of read about him sort of talking about his early career experiences and, like, where he came from and how he got to where he was and everything, like, a lot of it is the story of, like, an artist who believes that he has a lot to contribute and believes in his vision and things, but then always is put kind of on projects that he doesn't feel like are living up to their full potential, or is that he's restrained or whatever, which is not like an uncommon story for a lot of like artists. And then obviously once he is given the resources to do stuff, like he makes good things. So it sort of validates like his belief in his own abilities. But then that's how you sort of like, when you're kind of layering that onto other stories, I think that's how you can sort of accidentally get like objectivist stuff out of it, because like it makes sense from his experience as an artist of being like, I believe in my ability to do great things, let me do great things. But then when you have other characters saying that, then it just sort of sounds like I'm better than everyone else and I should be able to be above them doing my own thing. Like I get how those sorts of themes can sort of accidentally make their ways into that movie if that's like what's in his head at the time. And like it all makes sense. Like I know that some of like the Incredibles discourse often is sort of like it's objectivist, which equals bad. And like, I think it's a lot more nuanced than that. I think it speaks to a little bit of what he was going through. I think the movie itself, in even when it kind of brings up that kind of stuff, is a little more nuanced than I think people give it credit for. It's just, it's interesting. It's all a really cool conversation that you really can't have about a lot of movies. Like it just has that much going on, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's a good enough movie from a number of perspectives that some of that just might never hit you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it is just a good action movie. It is just a good family movie, like being about a family. It's a good enough character driven movie. Like there's just so many things going on that certain elements of it just might never hit you. And I think it's a testament to just how much was accomplished, whether he realized he was doing it or not.
Exactly.
And who knows? I mean, the way that he talks, I can never really tell if he actually knows what he was doing or is being coy about what he was doing, or once people recognize it, he just like, I have no idea. I don't know what he's doing. But in any case, he has spoken, obviously, about like his own inspiration for where this movie comes from. And I think it's not surprising what he identifies as the inspiration for The Incredibles, because I think it's the stuff you pull out first. I don't think the sort of the place that Brad Bird says he was coming from this movie is especially subtle in this movie. I think it's very right there. I think anybody who sees the movie can probably walk away with what Brad Bird will tell you the movie was about.
Yeah.
Because he identifies it as heroes navigating daily life and dead-end jobs and family squabbles and, like, spousal friction. You know what I mean? Those are all the things that are right there on screen for you to see. And, like, midlife crisis and a superhero couple distracted by trying to live in the real world. Like, those are all things that are right there. So it's, like, funny that that's kind of like Finding Nemo, where it was like, this movie's about trauma, but I couldn't find a single quote about Andrew Stanton talking trauma.
Yeah.
It would be like saying that, well, it's kind of like what he said, right? Like, Finding Nemo is a movie about the animal kingdom and how scary it is. Well, like, well, yeah, we see that part, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just, it's funny. I did find an Entertainment Weekly story that was published on the day that this movie was released widely. And it actually included a lot of really interesting stuff, or at least interesting because I didn't expect it necessarily, from Brad Bird and a little bit from John Lasseter talking about this movie. Mm-hmm. And they referenced something that I started to find validated in looking through reviews and stories about The Incredibles at the time, which was the idea that for some reason, The Incredibles was a movie that started to make critics and general audiences and I guess just like film connoisseurs like reevaluate animation again for some reason.
Oh, huh. Okay.
Which I thought was really strange, but I pulled some stuff from this Entertainment Weekly story, and then I pulled a specific quote from another story that I think was probably like the most straightforwardly representative of this.
Yeah.
So Brad Bird talks about animation. He says the ironic thing, and this movie, he says the ironic thing is that it's marketed as just another wacky fat guy rolling around on the floor in a supersuit. I know exactly what movie people think they are going to see. That was Andrew Stanton, actually. I don't know why he was talking about this, but whatever. Andrew Stanton is talking about The Incredibles. And he says, instead of a spandex spoof, it's a legitimate action picture with more emotional maturity than people expect of a live-action hero picture. Which, I mean, at the time, like, this is, what, 2004? So we've gotten a few, two Spider-Man movies?
Spider-Man 2 comes out this year. So, okay, like, they probably came out months apart from each other. So, like, it was in production, obviously, before Spider-Man 2 came out.
So that quote, I think, makes a little bit more sense in context. Because now, when you think of superhero movies in the context of the MCU and even the DC Extended Universe, you think of, like, well, wait, but superhero movies can be heist movies. Superhero movies can be family movies. Superhero movies can be comedy. Superhero movies can be anything. And that's not to say that they weren't before, but I don't think that's what the general public considered them to be.
Yeah.
So that quote makes sense in context, even though it struck me at first. And then this is where Brad Bird is talking. He says, animation is a strange medium in that people make assumptions about something simply because it's in that medium. We shook a lot of people with The Simpsons. I think people have forgotten that Bugs Bunny cartoons were made for people who were about to see the latest Humphrey Bogart movie. They weren't made for kids. Animation is a genre, or is not a genre. It's a medium, and it can express any genre. I think people often sell it short, but because it's animated, it must be for kids. You can't name another medium where people do that. I would argue puppetry is in that same category, but I get what he's saying.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not necessarily like a spicy take, but I do think with the conversation around The Incredibles that was happening about like, well, wait, this is an animated movie, but it's actually maybe kind of deep. You know, Finding Nemo was also deep, but I don't know that it was as obviously deep on the surface as I think Incredibles is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's probably where some of the conversation started. So this is the other quote that I pulled, and this is from a story in a publication called America titled The End of Cinema. And I had to read it because I was like,
oh my God,
why is this coming up as I search for materials on The Incredibles?
Oh, God.
And and it's a little hefty, but I pull out pieces that I think really reflect like the weird identity crisis that certain people were having for some reason at this point when The Incredibles came out.
Okay.
So this, So this is from Richard A. Blake, who I don't know. Someone out there's going to recognize that and be like, you're taking this guy too seriously. I don't know who the fuck he is. I just found this publication from like 2004, whatever.
Sure.
So he's talking about, he says, those of us who make a living out of going to the movies have been content, it seems, to lump all animation together as cartoon features, directed at children, but on occasion enjoyed with some embarrassment by adults. Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
But something strange has been going on in our media culture with the popularity and distinctly adult content of television series like The Simpsons, South Park, and most recently Drawn Together, coupled with a blossoming of the comic book mania and computer games. The old category of animated feature has suffered from a softening of the margins. What is a cartoon? A movie that's drawn? Kill Bill 1 and 2 might be considered Quentin Tarantino cartoons with live actors. So then he goes on to say, you know, what do we consider crossing the border? Along comes a smart film-savvy feature like The Incredibles, and we critic types are forced to once again reshuffle our presuppositions so that we can understand the films on their own terms and help our readers and students figure out what's happening to the movies and their culture.
Yeah, that's what a fucking critic does. That's what your job is. What do you? Why is this a surprise to you, dude?
But it's weird. That, like, why is this question being asked, though? You know what I mean? It's so strange to me. And it's funny looking back, you know, nearly two decades and being like, why is this a question? But if it was a question, clearly it's been answered by now. Because this year alone, as we record this, we just got the movie Soul. And about 5 years ago, we got the movie Inside Out. Like, what would those movies have done to this guy? You know what I mean? It would have shut down his entire brain.
Yeah, I guess so.
And he's not shitting on The Incredibles by any stretch of the imagination, because he goes on to say, like, the kid and movie fan in me enjoyed every minute of this lunacy. Weird. But the professional film critic in me left the theater with an academic headache. So it's like, it's so strange to me. And I found other you know, stories and reviews and stuff talking about how this movie was being taken seriously in a way that animation hadn't in a long time, which I do think is true. Like, that part I don't think anybody can really deny.
Sure.
But the fact that these folks are talking about it being considered, quote, film as opposed to, like, quote, movies is such a weird thing. And I would not have pegged The Incredibles as being the movie to start that conversation. Though I'm not surprised a Pixar movie was one of the movies to spark that conversation.
Yeah, I never considered The Incredibles was like a major pivot point for
right.
for like media critical conversations. It is interesting though, because a lot of that stuff, like, you could just copy and paste it into, like, I don't know, 10 years ago or 5 to 10 years ago, and just replace it with, like, conversations about, like, the Marvel Cinematic Universe or whatever.
Yep.
Like, anytime that there's something that was previously considered schlocky in the eyes of, like, academics or, like, more elite critics, like, that, then it's sort of like, wait, is this good? I don't understand. Me brain no understand bad thing be good. Like, it's just like, it's silly, because it's just like, because a lot of like major critics in the industry are just really insular about, like, the stuff that, like, that community is very insular, right? Like, there's very specific expectations. And I think it is changing for the better, like, within the last decade or so, just because of the way the media landscape has changed and the way that it is, like, everyone is a critic now, and it's a lot more easy to have a platform, for better and worse. But I think, like, there's been a lot more diverse voices in, like, in criticism in general. So it's, like, not necessarily just a bunch of, like, old stodgy white guys who went to NYU or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think that still exists, and that definitely existed in 2004. So, like, I'm not actually surprised that was, like, cartoon is good, but... I do think it is surprising, I guess, that it's The Incredibles, because I just never, it didn't feel like at the time that was, like, a turning point or anything.
No,
but.
And if you would have told me that a Brad Bird Pixar movie sparked this conversation, I wouldn't have said The Incredibles. I would have said Ratatouille, which I think most people would probably be like, a movie about rats seems like a strange choice. You know what I mean? Like, it already feels unconventional. And so, and again, I can't wait to watch it, but like that's what I would have pointed to, because in many ways, I think The Incredibles isn't surprising for a superhero movie if you are familiar with superhero stories. Do you know what I mean? So maybe it's more just a matter of how mainstream Pixar's films were and are. And so a lot of people who maybe went to see this were going to see it because it was Pixar, not because it's a superhero movie. And I do still think that The Incredibles will always be considered a Pixar movie before it is considered a superhero movie.
Right.
And I think that is what surprises people, I guess. Because here's
guess
the thing,
so.
If you've been reading Fantastic Four, if you've been reading X-Men or watched X-Men growing up, like, a lot of the stuff that this movie explores isn't new. It's just presented in a way that's really specific and very character and emotion forward, you know?
It's like the right kind of like derivative, like where it's just like there's a reason that things that are derivative exist. It's because you can lay a familiar foundation and then play with it without having like we don't get any origin stories or whatever, because who gives a fuck? They're just classic superheroes. You understand the rules of being a superhero. You understand that there are secret identities. That stuff is there because everyone's familiar with it because it's derivative, and then they go and play with it and do new things with it and do spins on it from there.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of almost a decade ahead of its time in that regard with regards to superhero movies, because the idea of superheroes and all the rules are understood already, and so then they just tell a story inside that context. That's normal now. It wasn't at the time. And still isn't for a lot of stories.
Yeah, or, you know, even, like, a lot of the stuff that you get that is sort of, like, a deconstruction of superhero stuff is just that. Like, it's, like, a Watchmen thing or something very, very gritty and dark, you know, or, like, any Zack Snyder movie. Whereas Pixar or The Incredibles is, like, no, you can, like, sort of have, like, interesting spins and even deconstructions to an extent of superhero stuff without it being, like, dark, you know? Like, it can still be a superhero movie by playing with those things. And I wonder if, like, the critical conversation thing, it really is just super surface in that it's, like, they want to see a cartoon, and it maybe doesn't even have anything to do with the superhero stuff. It is literally, like, wait, like, it's more about the parents, and it's about a midlife crisis, and, like, the wife thinks he's having an affair. Like, this is adult, you know? Like, maybe it's just not more than that.
Well, I think that speaks to Andrew Stanton's quote about, I know exactly what movie people think they're going to see. I mean, that couldn't have just been Andrew Stanton. I'm sure that Brad Bird knew that, and John Lasseter knew that, and I'm sure they all knew that, and they were all sort of excited by that. And that probably was part of the marketing, even though the marketing obviously is going to focus on just getting as many people in there as possible, which, of course, is going to focus on the fat guy rolling around in a super suit, you know?
Right.
So there's something sort of all mixed up together in that just worked really, really well. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that's expectations. But yeah, maybe that's really what it sort of boils down to. It's just like the expectation for this movie was so different than the actual product in a way that the Pixar movies preceding it, and definitely the Disney movies at the time preceding it, because this is well beyond the Renaissance era, which wasn't exactly, you know, the Renaissance era wasn't exactly, they weren't throwing you curveballs either. They weren't trying to, like, they were selling you a musical and you got a musical, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it is really a lot of just that, but so okay, I'm fascinated because I really genuinely am surprised that you had seen this maybe one time prior to now. So I just want to dive in right away to just some of your thoughts, wherever you want to begin, as far as like, I haven't seen this movie in probably 10 years.
Yeah, well, it is funny. I mean, I first saw it when I was in college, I think. So like, it isn't like a Bug's Life situation where I remembered none of it. Like, I remembered more of the broad strokes than in like Monsters, Inc. or a Bug's Life, despite only having seen it the one time.
That's still probably before the entirety of the MCU or just as it was beginning. So, like, the context and landscape has still changed dramatically.
That's true. I mean, yeah, and it's still – that still was, like, yeah, that was still probably, like, well over a decade ago now. So, yeah, I mean – Yeah. It wasn't like watching it with like fresh eyes or anything necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it, and the other side too, is that like, because I listened to lots of podcasts about like The Simpsons, so Brad Bird comes up a lot. I've recently listened to a podcast about The Iron Giant, because like I said, it's like one of my favorite movies, and Brad Bird comes up a lot. So like, by its nature, if you're doing any kind of retrospective podcast that references Brad Bird, Incredibles comes up a lot. So like, I think that I had a lot of like feelings and ideas going into it. So it wasn't like I went into this movie this time like just shocked at how adult it was or whatever, you know? So it wasn't like that kind of experience. But even though I was sort of looking for a lot of the like objectivist discourse that I've heard about it or whatever, it still surprised me like how good it is. Like, it's very, very good, and I'm super into it. And even with looking for a lot of that stuff, it's just sort of like, oh, okay, I get where it comes from, but I also think it lands on a different place than people give it credit for on like the negative things that they have. But I think it is a complicated movie. I think that's what I'll say up front, is that the kind of general feelings that I had is that it's just a really a surprisingly complex movie and complicated movie. And I think that that is what's really fascinating about it, is that there's just like a lot happening and a lot going on, both on like plot level, character level, and thematic level. And that makes it really cool and good, and also good action and fun movie. So,
I mean, were there things that, like, I feel like each movie we've watched, for the most part, there have been things that either you and I have been like, oh my God, that's right, that scene. Mm-hmm. Were there, I mean, even just from that level of just that, not even like digging in,
yeah,
were there things that you had forgotten were a part of the movie?
I guess like just how directly they acknowledge like the adult life and like in death and stuff, like the fact that they do call out the guy committing suicide is a guy committing suicide, and
oh
he says
God,
that he
right.
wanted to commit suicide, like that's right up front.
It is the first PG movie from Pixar, watch out.
yeah like stuff like that, where it isn't so much that like plenty of like Pixar movies ahead of this have had like adult themes and stuff like that, but I think this one is interesting in how directly it confronts everything, does not bury anything. It's like Mr. Incredible has a mimosa. They call it a mimosa. Yeah,
yeah.
It's an alcoholic
that
drink
stuck out
in a kid's
to me.
Movie. Yeah, it
that
did too.
Genuinely stuck out to me, and I'd never really thought about or noticed that before. The mimosa, for some reason. Like, obviously the violence of it, I recall, because it's a superhero movie. But for some reason, the mimosa really stuck out to me.
Yeah. It's a lot of, I think it's a lot of subtle things and details in this movie is what makes it so surprising, of like stuff where, we've been going through all these Spider-Man cartoons on Walloping Web Snappers. And, mm-hmm. and it's always funny that even as adults as the shows want to go, there's always like very clear things that they're always hiding. They're never going to show someone actually having alcohol, or they're going to like awkwardly redraw the stuff in the wine glass as like water or something like that, or
yeah.
call it grape juice or whatever. And so the simple fact that they are actually calling out a mimosa, well, they didn't even have to. They could have just given him a drink and he drank it, and you could assume whatever it is. Like, it's a thing that like is minor, but there's so many of those types of instances in this movie where it's like he's drinking a mimosa, the guy is committing suicide, we're going to call it suicide and say that it is a person who wants to take their own life by jumping off of a building in front of everyone and not hiding it. All the death in it that they call out as death, like that they show people getting sucked into jet engines multiple times. Like, mm-hmm. it's just, if it was like one scary moment, it would be one thing, but there's just so many of them.
Yeah.
And it goes beyond like, wow, this movie is more adult than you remember. It's just like, no, it's just like they were really kind of treating it like it was just a movie for adults that happened to be an animated movie. You know, it's really, and just the extent of it, I think, was surprising to me.
I also think, and I don't think anything you're saying is wrong, but I also think that it's important to clarify that, like, it's not adult because people die or because they acknowledge suicide, but because of the darkness of the humor. Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Because they could have been making a movie that adults can kind of appreciate that isn't that. Like, it's specifically surprising because the humor is dark. I would argue, you know, it's so funny because the next few episodes we do, Soul's probably going to come up each time, even though we're not going to actually talk about it for many, many months. But, like, Soul, again, is a pretty adult movie, but not because it's dark necessarily, or not because it's cynical, but because it's like heady, you know?
Well, and also, and just unafraid.
And unafraid, yeah.
Yeah.
This one is just like, it's got like a darkness in its humor that's, or like an irreverence almost in some of its humor that feels strange to this point in Pixar, and probably even after, you know? Like
yeah.
you said, the people getting sucked into jet engines. There's really no other way to interpret that. And I know it's like, they're not big things in that they're not dwelled upon, but the fact that that guy is committing suicide and the fact that people are getting sucked into jet engines, mm-hmm. like they're also not just jokes. Like, they affect specifically the events of the movie.
Yeah.
And if you took them out, you'd have to figure out a way around it.
The fact that, like, I mean, the no capes thing is like, has been a meme since 2004,
mm-hmm.
but the no capes thing stems from a death montage. It's just a montage of people dying kind of violently because of their capes. And that's, and I mean, it's a thing that you remember. It's a thing that's important in the movie. It's like a plot point that they establish, you know, like it's in its bones, you know? So it's interesting. Like, yeah, like you said, you can't just like strip away a lot of that stuff. And it isn't just like, you know, violence and alcohol and stuff, like just the amount of attention. Well, the simple fact that the main characters are Bob and Helen, not the kids, like, the kids are kind of annoying for a big chunk of the movie. And it's on purpose because then they have their kind of character development and it's just, they're just written very realistically, like annoying brats, essentially.
I love Violet.
I love them. But when they're together though, like the fighting that they do and stuff, sure, intentionally, they're meant to just be like,
they're grating.
Right.
I mean, they're pushing the parents who are already on their last, you know, nerves even further. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they're meant to do.
It's well done. I mean, that's I think Brad Bird, based on this and Iron Giant, I think he like writes kids really well, where it's like striking that balance of like, realistically, kids are fucking annoying. Like they just are. But that doesn't mean that they can't be sympathetic and like complex at the same time. Like, I think there's a really great balance that you strike. And he definitely strikes it really well in this movie. Cause then, you know, once they start coming onto their own and everything, like, you actually, like, you're already sympathizing with them anyway. But then it's like a fist pump thing every time they do something cool. Cause it's like, yeah, you were just like a kid and now you're doing something incredible, no pun intended, you know?
It's also the balance between the childlike genuineness and authenticity of somebody like Dash and the sort of guarded and less authentic Helen and Bob. You know what I mean? Like, it's not just that he knows how annoying they are, but also how, like, you know, warm they can be. It's like that actual dynamic. And obviously Violet's sort of in between because she's a teenager. But Dash is really authentic, too. Like, he's annoying, but it's because he's not self-conscious. He's just, he doesn't have much of a filter like, 9-year-old would or whatever. I don't actually know how old they're supposed to be. I just know Violet's a teenager.
Oh, yeah. I don't really know how old Dash is supposed to be either. But as, like, a kid who just doesn't have an outlet, like, isn't allowed to do the thing that he loves to do, like, it makes sense. And he's going to be acting out and everything. Like, it all makes sense. And you sympathize with them even when they're being obnoxious, you know? Yeah. And that's really... it's really well done.
No outlet? Like all of them.
That's true.
It's kind of like a crux of the movie.
Every character has moments when they just absolutely fucking suck. But you never like don't understand where they're coming from or why they're doing what they're doing, you know?
I mean, I don't argue with you on that they suck, but I feel like it's, I don't know. I don't know if I would say that because it's so clear that they're just being like stymied, you know what I mean? And doesn't mean that they're not like taking it out in weird ways, but it's so, and I guess that's just a testament to Brad Bird's ability to portray these characters because at no point am I ever like, even though I know what they're doing, I never really sit there and think like, my God, stop being such a dick or, you know what I mean? Like they arguably are being terrible at certain points, but they're so relatable that I never find myself like shouting at the screen or at the characters like I might for other movies where I'm just like, you are unbearable, you know?
Yeah.
And actually that, you know, I wish I could remember where I saw this. This had to have come from Pixar. So maybe it was from one of the books, but I remember seeing something about how, you know, each Pixar movie they've done to this point, they've had to figure out certain elements that would ensure that characters who are complex aren't unlikable. You know, like we've talked about that with Toy Story. We talked about that with Finding Nemo. And one of the things they had to figure out with this movie was like, if Bob is somebody who is seen as cheating on his wife, even though we know better, right? Like if Helen is somebody who is seen as keeping the family together or trying to at least, and Bob from her perspective is cheating on her, how do we ensure that Bob doesn't just look like an asshole and like an abusive husband?
Right.
And one thing that they pointed to about like Bob being this literal super-powered, super strength, like strong guy yelling at his wife, how do we balance that out? And this was so, it was such a small thing that I'd never thought about, but it's so obvious once it's pointed out. The scene where the two of them are yelling at each other and they get caught by their kids yelling at each other, the thing that sort of balances it out to make it not look like Bob is just being a total shithead to his wife is the fact that Helen gradually gets taller and taller and taller until her stature is beyond what he can accomplish.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they were like, that is the stuff we have to be really conscious of, because we can't allow Bob to just be this, you know, guy who yells at his wife every other day because he's unhappy when she's also unhappy and doesn't necessarily do that.
That's so interesting. It's so funny that, like, every single Pixar movie through this, with maybe, I guess, the exception of A Bug's Life, have, like, main characters who were just on the verge of just being the most unlikable characters, or, like, in an earlier draft, like, was a jerk. Like, it's
because
so funny that they
keep... human.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're all so real, and I think everybody has those moments with themselves where they have to fight being an asshole.
Yeah.
And I think that's what these characters are doing. It's just that they're being created by somebody else, so there's, like, an extra amount of care that goes into it. Like, Bob Parr can't check himself. Brad Bird has to check Bob Parr for him, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it makes sense. I think what's funny about that is it's a testament to how good and relatable the characters are, as opposed to how – well, no, I was about to say as opposed to how fragile they are, but I think their fragility is what makes them very human.
Yeah. That was kind of the other thing that I was starting to get at when we were just starting talking about the interesting, like, adult things about the movie or whatever, is because it focuses so much on Bob and Helen, like, so much of the plot, any plot that isn't directly the actual supervillain plot is stuff that is just right out of, like, a family drama, you know, like, or an adult romantic drama or something. Like, everything with Bob and his job and his midlife crisis is, like, so real, which if Brad Bird was going through that actual thing at that point in his life or recently, it makes sense. But, like, the way that he's portrayed at his job and the fact that his whole job is just drawn very gray, and, like, that he's working an insurance claim adjuster person, like, just the most, like, evil job that a good person could work, you know?
A superhero who's not allowed to use his superpowers to help people works at an insurance claims company where he's encouraged not to help people.
Right.
So even in his daily life, where he theoretically should be able to do small deeds to help people, he's not allowed to.
Yeah, and it's just really, I mean, I think a lot of people have felt that. That's something that I definitely, like, didn't relate to when I was watching it originally, that I relate to a lot more now. Like, I've never... thankfully, and never will, like, worked at an insurance company, but I have worked in healthcare administration and had to deal with insurance claims. So, like, I'm not making the decision, but I still have to, like, communicate with people and make other decisions similar to it. That it's just like, oh, yeah, you know, I know you need to, like, live, but I might just have to tell you that you can't. Sorry. And it's really, like, it fucks with you, especially if you're somebody who wants to be a good person. And I think the movie, even though it's kind of like limited screen time for it, it portrays that extremely well. Like, it's to a slightly cartoonish extent, obviously, but I think, like, that feeling of just utter despair and just this, like, grief for the life that you want to have or could have had or had before, like, it is really incredibly portrayed and very real, and something that a kid would not ever be able to comprehend outside of maybe recognizing their own parent in Bob. You know what I mean? Which itself is kind of fucked up, so.
Yeah, or just a very simple idea of, like, do what makes you happy, but not beyond that sort of, like, very early concept of the deeper sort of philosophical piece of that.
Because there's always, you know, we always talk about, like, the existential stuff that Pixar movies do, and this is sort of, like, a different kind of existential thing, because it's a lot more, it's still, like, existential, but in a very grounded way. It's literally just, like, I want to live even a semblance of a fulfilling life, and I'm just not allowed to because of the way that the system works that I have to live in.
Yeah.
And there's nothing I can do, and just the utter despair at that. Like, that's pretty soul crushing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I, so most of the story is told from Bob's perspective, obviously, because he's the one that's sort of going through the obvious on-screen midlife crisis. But what do you make of Helen? Because I think if you just look beyond Bob, like, Helen is obviously going through something, I think, very similar, but just has a different, like, different expectations on her shoulders, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd be really curious to, like, see a companion movie from the exact other perspective, you know what I mean? And we get some of it. But because this is about Bob sort of confronting his shit, we don't see as much of Helen.
Yeah, I like her a lot. I think that, like, out of the whole family, well, Violet's fine too, but like, really, actually, I was going to say, like, she's like the one where, like, her issues, like, manifest, like, in the least bad way, but that's not really true. It's really just compared to Bob, like, I think she's going through a lot of shit, and it obviously doesn't manifest in great ways sometimes, but I think, like, she obviously is, like, meant to be a more level-headed person, so it doesn't really manifest in, like, destructive ways or anything.
Well, that's why I'd be curious, though, because we get most things from... I know it's not first person through Bob's perspective, but we get most things through Bob's perspective, and I think Bob views Helen as the one who's got this, right? Like, She's got this. She's got everything under control. But we do see little bits and pieces of, like, Helen yelling at the kids and their reaction to that. Her yelling back at Bob, which he deserves. But you know what I mean? Like, the two of them do the same thing where he puffs his chest up and she gets literally bigger than him.
Yeah.
The moment where she yells at Violet and nearly damages her relationship with Violet as a result, you know, like, she then has to repair her own shit. The way. So I would be really curious to see, like, you know, what does Helen Parr's life look like at this moment in time, you know, before we hit the end of the movie or the climax of the movie, when the Bob and the kids aren't around or whatever. It's hard because she has a newborn baby. So, like, what does she even get to do?
Right.
But I would love to see more from that side of things.
Yeah, which itself, you know, is I think could be compelling because just the idea of, like, yearning for something more, but from the perspective of, like, a family that you love and wanted to have and probably loved to have, but still are yearning for more, which, she definitely is. That's different than the yearning for more because of the job that you work. Like, there's something very fundamentally different in exploring that, and we don't really get
we don't get that here, but it's a fascinating story, and I feel like we do get that story in other media a lot of times where it's like and again, I watch a lot of reality competitions, and so there are, like, certain archetypes that you see a lot, and one of a really common archetype on something like Survivor is, like, the mom who's doing something for herself, you know what I mean? I feel like Helen Parr would fit exactly into that type of character, because, like, from our perspective in this movie, from Bob's perspective, and probably from her own, all she gets to do is keep things together. I mean, her superpower is literally stretching. Like, it's not, you know, it's she's a mom who's stretching herself thin, and her power is literally stretching. Like, it's right there, you know?
Yeah. Mom's got to be flexible.
Yeah, exactly. Mom's got to be flexible. Dad's got to be strong. The superpowers are very intentional. I mean, That's that's right there.
Yeah.
But I think they don't necessarily call a ton of attention to it, so it ends up being familiar without being super in your face.
Yeah. I like her. I like how they do her powers. Like, they do so many cool things with her stretching powers. Just so much.
Oh my gosh, yep.
Like, when she turns into a boat. Perfect. Amazing. Love it.
One of my favorite moments, like superpower moments from this movie, is when she turns into a boat and has Dash serve as the motor.
It's so clever. Like,
that's brilliant.
Yeah. That is the kind of stuff that is generally missing from a lot of live action superhero stuff, including the Fantastic Four movies that also have a stretchy person that does that kind of stuff in the comics. Like, the movies never get that creative with it. And it's like, you can do it.
I don't know exactly what needed to be changed, but apparently, I'll have to look into this further, but apparently the Fantastic Four movie that was, you know, in development at the time had to change certain things about their movie when The Incredibles came out, because they were like, well, fuck, we're making a family superhero movie too.
They should have made it a little... I don't hate that movie as much as a lot of people do. I don't think it's good, but I think it's fun. But
I don't remember very much from it at all.
They should have made it more like The Incredibles. Like, you shouldn't have worried about that. It would have been better if you did try to copy The Incredibles a little bit, honestly.
I'm sure. We brought up the kids a little bit. I said I really like Violet. I remember liking Violet even the first time I saw it, and I've always liked Violet. Any other thoughts on the kids?
I wish you'd seen more of Violet. Oh, that's funny. I didn't actually mean to do that. I wish you'd seen more of Violet.
All of your unintentional puns. Wow.
I know, right?
You should start taking credit for those.
I should. But her story was also very straightforward. It's just, you know, a teenage girl who needs to get some confidence, and she does, and that's great, and love to see it.
And her powers are being invisible and putting up walls around herself, so bada bing, bada boom, there you go.
Love that stuff. The simplicity of it is perfect.
Yeah.
And they do as cool a stuff as they can with her. She's one that I would hope gets more to do in the sequel, because I do feel like she's like kind of underutilized in this movie.
Her power set, I think, is by far the best one. Like, I think if I could have one of the Incredibles, it would be hers, because she not only can she be invisible, but she can create tangible force fields that have a physical, like, I mean, I almost that was really redundant. I was going to say tangible force fields with a physical property. That's literally what tangible is. But like, she can use them in ways that are both defensive and offensive.
Yeah.
Like, theoretically, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I will say, when I play Lego The Incredibles, I use her a lot.
Yeah, I would love to see them do more with her. It's the same thing with, like, Invisible Woman / like Invisible Girl from Fantastic Four, is that it's just like, depending on who's doing it, sometimes she's just the worst and sometimes she's like the most powerful. Like, it just depends. You just have to get creative with the powers, but you can do a lot of really great stuff with it. So hope to see more of it in the sequel for sure.
She should be the most powerful.
Yeah, she should. It makes sense.
But because she doesn't have confidence, she's like, she's the character in the movie that doesn't even really have a full understanding or control over her power. So it almost like fits into that, like, that like Jean Grey-ish mold where it's like, I have not yet reached my full potential, and if I do, watch out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, she's cool. It's cute. I think one of the counterpoints to like the sort of like objectivist reading of the movie is like with the way that the way that both Violet and Dash end, but especially Violet, because like her powers have nothing to do with her confidence at the end of the movie. In the very like last scene of it, is she's just generally more confident and gets to go on a date with the boy she likes by being seen. Mm-hmm. She doesn't go invisible to like she doesn't use her powers to like get a date or whatever, you know. It's just like her powers allowed her, embracing her powers allowed her to be more confident, ergo she's able to just live her life with confidence, even if she's living as a relatively normal person like otherwise at school, you know. So which I love that a lot.
And you can't separate that from the fact that she embraced her powers as a result of protecting her family.
Like,
a big part of this movie is literally them going to an island called No Manasan Island. And then they learn to embrace each other and let each other back in. And once they do that, all their powers together are better. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, that's, like, a big part of it. Because Violet is a stereotypical teenager who shuts her family out.
Mm-hmm.
And then once she sort of lets them in, and once she gets the affirmation from her mom that I'm sure she wasn't getting because her parents have been preoccupied. Well, one of her parents has been preoccupied with keeping them all a secret, while the other one is just leaving to avoid being a secret. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She's probably not heard Violet, you can do this, very many times before.
Yeah.
More like Violet, don't do this. So.
Right. And I do like, I really, really like all the moments they have kind of in the last, like the last half of the movie, with how protective both she and Dash are of each other, which is, I think.
They get it faster than the parents do.
Yeah.
They get it immediately.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like the thing where it justifies all the squabbling and stuff that they do earlier in the movie. Like, even though it can get grating, it's like, because just like a realistic brother and sister, like they can fight all the time, but they still love each other. And on almost like a more base level than, like the parents do, because they don't have baggage or anything. They're fighting because they're siblings. And then, but they also don't want to see the other one hurt. And it's like impulse, like just working on base impulse. Like, all right, cool. My brother's in trouble. Going to create a force field that I've never made before without even having to think about it. You know, I love that stuff.
And Dash literally like beats a guy up saying like, leave my sister alone or whatever, something to that effect.
Love it. It's awesome. It's so good.
They're great together.
Yeah. And they have a high kill count in this movie too.
Okay. That is worth mentioning, because one thing that's really, I think, not very obvious until you watch it, or watch for it maybe, is that Violet and Dash, they come into their powers very naturally, probably because they come into their powers together. Dash, I mean, his power is very straightforward and he's been experimenting with it for a while. But as far as like using them in a superheroic way, they come into it together. They have no remorse and they do not look back at killing many goons. Like, yeah. Dash is responsible. I mean, quote, responsible. I mean, he's defending himself and running away.
Yeah.
But, like, he's not killing them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Which
Violet's
is so-
not killing them. And neither one of them seems, at least in this movie, granted, everything happens over the course of, like, 24 hours at the end, right? Mm-hmm. Neither one of them stops to be like, this is disturbing, or is like haunted at what they've done, which is fine. It's a superhero movie. We know who the bad guys are.
Right.
Like, the bad guys, the goons don't get characterization. But it is funny when you think about it. Like, this child and his teenage sister just savagely killed a bunch of dudes who were trying to kill them. And really never thought twice about it.
Which, and it's funny too, because like around that same time, there's also the scene where Mr. Incredible has Mirage in a place where he could just like kill her. And granted, it would be in cold blood, which is very different than like in defense.
Right.
And the way that Dash and Violet were. But they still make a big deal about how he like can't do it, despite at that point thinking that his entire family is dead. And it's like, mm-hmm. I would be like, you know, I would kill a person too if I thought you killed my whole family. Like, I wouldn't blame you, man.
That is rough when Syndrome says, like, you couldn't even do it when you had nothing to lose. Like,
yeah.
Good Lord.
It is. But it's so interesting seeing that and then also seeing the kids slaughter people.
Yeah.
Well, again,
the kids are down
it's
to
not
business. Like, you know, like the kids have been ready to embrace their family and they finally get the chance to do it, which coincides with them being ready to embrace their powers and getting the chance to do it. So it makes sense, but it is a very interesting juxtaposition.
And it isn't like Dash is actually like super speed choking somebody out with his hands.
No,
they
no,
just
no,
like
no.
run and let them crash into walls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's still interesting. And I do think that they make great strides to set up the direness of the situation when you have Helen like give them that whole speech about how it's like these aren't bad guys like on TV, even though you were children, will kill you. Like these are
bad people.
I think
that's important.
Yeah.
I think that's a reason that you don't think about it, right? Because and I think Brad Bird's talked about that. Like he wanted to make sure that the stakes were palpable in that these adult goons do not care, like Helen says, that you are children. Like they'll just kill you. That's all there is to it. And the fact that, you know, Mirage pauses, but Syndrome doesn't give a fuck that there are kids on that plane. Granted, he doesn't know if that's true or not, but he doesn't stop to think about it. And that's honestly, like, I've seen this movie a bunch of times, and I don't know why it hit me today, but when she says there are children on the plane and Bob screams no, that, like, hit me today when I was watching it. I was like, oh my God, this is so rough. It's a genuinely horrifying moment.
It is. It's played. That's another thing that like is really interesting about the movie, because when you have the movie's perspective always being from the adults rather than the kids, even in this movie that a lot of people are coming to thinking that it's for their kids, like it's like I think it's framed differently when you're following more from kids' perspectives in movies. Like the direness of situations is different, but like when you're seeing the entire movie through the eyes of the parents, it makes the prospect of thinking that your kids are dying just like it hits that much harder, because you are seeing through the eyes of a parent rather than the eyes of a kid who doesn't really understand, you know. And I think that whole sequence is played out really well, because it's clear that Helen leaves the "there are children on here" thing until like a last resort. Like she doesn't want to reveal that her kids are on the plane.
Ugh.
So it's like, it's just like, please, this is me basically being on my hands and knees begging you.
Yeah.
And just the despicableness of like, I don't care. Kill them anyway. Yep. Kill all the kids. Like, yeah. Syndrome's a scary ass villain. So
Syndrome is very scary.
Yeah.
Syndrome is genuinely scary.
It shocked me how scary he was on this watch. Like I didn't remember him being as scary as he is, but he was frightening.
Yeah, because it's a kind of scary that stems from obsession, like a very, very specific obsession and long-term obsession. I mean, we get him set up at the beginning of the movie, which is at least a dozen years and then some prior to the events of the rest of the movie, because Bob and Helen don't have kids yet and Violet is a teenager, right? So like he's had this obsession with Mr. Incredible, specifically Mr. Incredible. I mean, for all intents and purposes, Syndrome is Mr. Incredible's legitimate stalker. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's everything that drives him to become what he is and do everything he does at the end. And there's an irony there, right? Like the movie is all about, again, no man is an island and like letting people in and you can't tackle everything on your own and all this sort of stuff. And part of what we're set up with as being the beginning of the conflict is Mr. Incredible not allowing this kid to be a part of his world. But then that kid goes on to obsess and basically not care about anybody else there, and then like turns himself into sort of the evil version of not letting anybody in and doing everything on your own. Like, he literally kills all the other superheroes so that he can be the only one left.
Yeah. And like with Mr. Incredible, he's like the ultimate version of like the kind of like reply guy that doesn't get a response and then just like start sending like nasty messages after
gosh.
You know what I mean, where it's just sort of like I love you so much, you're great, wow, you fucking bitch, you didn't respond to me, like it's just he's just like that, you know. And I think the movie handles it really well because it's sort of like initially in the prologue it's like, oh, he's annoying, but like I do feel bad for him because Mr. Incredible is really mean to him. He doesn't need to be so mean to him and embarrass him, and it's like very totally valid backstory, like totally understandable. And so you could see a version of this movie where he is just fully sympathetic villain throughout the entire movie, and then maybe they find forgiveness later on or something like that. The movie just sort of is just like, eh, I mean, what Mr. Incredible did was shitty. Like, he didn't handle that situation well, but clearly Syndrome wasn't, like, a good person. He wasn't, probably wasn't coming out of this from a good place, because everything that he does is just, like, so over-the-top sadistic as an adult that, like, at a certain point you can't feel bad for him anymore.
Yeah, it goes from being potentially sympathetic villain into, like, the guy who obsesses so much with somebody that they then try to kill them, you know, like it's such a leap that you're like, okay, now I'm just, I just find you terrifying.
Yeah. Because like the stuff that he does do, obviously, like objectively a lot of really cool stuff in how he creates this great technology, right? Like he has enough technology to become a superhero. He could easily be like a Batman or an Iron Man type of hero if he wanted to be. But
there's commentary there. I don't know if Brad Bird knew he was making it, but there's commentary there.
Right. That's the thing that makes it really complicated, because it's sort of like the worldview of him, at least, if not the whole movie, probably more the character, is sort of like, well, the world only allows superheroes who are like biologically born to be superheroes or having actual superpowers. So someone genetically superior, right? So I'm trying to be someone who's like building myself up, lifting myself up by my own bootstraps, building myself up from my own ingenuity and my own like abilities and working my way up to the top. Another, you know, a parallel version of that story is sort of like, oh, that's really great that like you can come above your, you know, the class that you're in or like the restrictions that you were under or something like that. Any sort of any sort of anything that was holding you back, you are able to overcome it if you like try hard enough and stuff like that. And the movie frames that as like a very villainous, or it doesn't frame the act as villainous, but the only character that we see doing that is just the most villainous of the villainous. And that's
exactly
hard to really parse, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then when you pair that with the whole, like, if everyone's special, nobody's special type stuff, like you just get into like weird spaces.
It's hard because like, I see how you can accidentally arrive to that. If you are like in real life, Brad, like I was saying earlier, like, Brad Bird was an artist who felt like he was, you know, not living up to the potential that he just had, like the talent that he had, and instead not wanting to work in mediocrity anymore, wanted to rise above that and do something special. And you're also doing a story about superheroes in a superhero media where, yeah, a lot of superheroes are just people that have powers that are objectively like better than a regular person has, because they're superpowers. So like I could see between those two things, you can sort of like accidentally arrive to this sort of weirdly problematic objectivist, almost like eugenicist kind of view that the movie accidentally has, you know?
Yeah.
It's weird.
But I mean, you also, any piece of art can be so many things, and any piece of art can contradict itself, right? Because you can also, it's missing a couple pieces for this to be strong, which I'll acknowledge at the top, but you can also arrive at the conclusion that even in the context of if everybody's special, nobody is, you've got two characters who say that, right? You got Dash saying that when he's disappointed at not being allowed to use his superpowers, which is a specific restriction Helen is putting on him for their safety that we are then to understand is wrong. And the only other person who makes that assertion is the villain, who's legitimately terrifying. And by the end of the movie, the parents do allow their kids to live their lives with powers. And so you could say, like, okay, well, they learn that that is not true, and they learn that being special can exist for every person, and it is more a matter of recognizing what is special about you, not what is special about you in relation to other people exclusively. So, like, you can still get there, but I do think there are maybe a couple pieces missing, and those pieces aren't as explicit as some of the other pieces to really combat that head on.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had the one line that I absolutely hated where Bob is like, you know, they're just creating new ways to celebrate mediocrity. But, you know, when someone's genuinely exceptional, they like don't get anything or whatever, which is like so like participation trophy ranting, you know. And granted, like, I think he says that during a point when like he's not in a great place in his life. So you could argue that like it's not meant to be framed as the right thing, but it's not challenged at all, you know?
Well, that's what's hard about this movie is so many things that they're saying are things that deserve to be challenged. But all of our main characters are going through things that they're trying to overcome. So none of them are saying these things from their best selves or from their authentic places. You know what I mean? It might be a genuine frustration he's feeling as a result of what he's going through. But we see who Bob Parr can be by the end. And he wasn't there when he said that thing.
So
it's like it's weird because you're like, well, that's who you were for most of the movie. And that was right there front and center. Kind of like Dash saying, if you know, if everybody's special, nobody's special. Well, Dash wasn't in his best place when he said that. So, you know, you end up with these, it's not really unreliable narratives because they're not unreliable, but they're expressing viewpoints that are sort of tinged with disappointment or fear or anxiety or tension or whatever. And I think if you examine it through that lens, then you could start to be like, well, a lot of these things they're saying we're not to understand or being said by people that we're meant to trust because of what they're going through or whatever the case may be.
It's, I mean, it's a thing that I honestly is as much as some of the stuff I don't like some of these individual lines, like in a vacuum, the fact that all this is in this movie is kind of what makes me like it a lot because it's so complicated, you know? And I think that there are so many different ways you can look at it. I also think the fact that like, despite all of that, in the end, what they land on with Dash is that, yeah, you can use your powers and participate in track, but don't just win every race. Like, you have to come in second sometimes, which challenges that the whole kind of Randian argument, because it's like, if they were going full objectivists and full, like, eugenics biology, if you're, you know, you're just biologically better than other people, if they were going full on with that, he would just win every race. But the fact that he doesn't is like, okay, but still recognize that you do have an advantage that not everyone has, and you can still like use that to help, you know, live with that, be your truest self, but for the sake of other people, like hold back. Or you could argue maybe he's holding back just to keep his secret identity secret. I don't know. or it could be both.
I think you could, and this is a little bit of work on our part, but I think you can arrive at the conclusion that it's not just for himself, because Helen learns by the end that like being so militant about protecting themselves is only hurting their family more.
Yeah.
Again, not super direct or explicit on screen, but I guess if you wanted to argue it, that's probably where you'd start.
Yeah.
But it still ends up being sort of ambiguous in that regard.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just maybe like the point of it is that it's just like it's a more nuanced conversation than you would initially realize if a superhero family like this really existed, that it wouldn't be so cut and dry. And they tried making it a cut and dry thing when they tried to just live militantly and in secret, and that didn't work. So they're trying something a little more nuanced rather than just swinging the pendulum all the way to the other end.
Well, I think this movie probably works best or is at its most genuine when it is in the midst of frustration and tension. And because it is a movie, because it is a movie by Pixar, because it's a movie that's supposed to be a particular story with a beginning and an end, like it has to tie up in a particular way, which forces you to draw conclusions. And I don't actually think this movie is at its best when you're trying to draw conclusions from it. I think it's at its best when you're relating to the character's struggles. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So trying to tie it up at the end almost like trips everything up a little bit because you're that's like, true. Well, I don't know if that's entirely what we're supposed to get out of it, but they had to end somewhere. It had to conclude somehow.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, because it all makes everything that it lands on for the individual characters and their stories all make sense. It's just like the way all of it together forms a larger like thematic, kind of thematic point that you can pull from it depending on your perspective. That's when it gets sort of, that's when it becomes a problem, you know?
Which doesn't make it bad. It just means like the portrait of the family is the strongest element of the movie, not the theme that this set out to tackle necessarily.
Yeah. And I do think like for certain people, there's a message there that works really well where it's just like, if you're someone who is sort of like maybe unconfident in your abilities, like if you aren't the type of artist who knows you're a visionary or whatever, if you are the more like imposter syndrome prone type of person where it's just like, no, recognize your talents and go for it. Like don't hold yourself back to try to be normal or whatever that means. Like shoot for the stars, go for what you think you deserve ultimately, right? And that can be taken to a darker place, but generally if it's just trying to like do your best, you know, I think there's a good message in here that you can pull from this movie. It just is not one that applies to or works for everyone, you know?
Totally. Other characters wise, just because it's worth mentioning some of these folks, any thoughts on Lucius / Frozone? Not like a huge part of this movie, but he's fun.
Yeah, I remembered him being a bigger part of this movie than he actually was. Maybe because he's like in the marketing and stuff. Yeah, he's kind of barely there. He's fun though.
Yeah,
he's a lot of fun. It's fun that they had have a classic like Iceman kind of character, and they do fun stuff with him.
Yeah. Interestingly, like there are only a handful of other characters voiced by like actors. This movie has so many characters because it's a pretty compact cast, right? Like you've got the family, you've got the main villain. We mentioned Mirage, and then other than that, you've got Lucius. You've got Wallace Shawn's character, who's Bob's boss for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get John Ratzenberger's character, who's only at the end.
Love it. I love that. I think so far my favorite John Ratzenberger cameo.
It's amazing. It's so amazing. So good. And then other than that, like Edna Mode. But Edna Mode is voiced by Brad Bird. So like, it's it's a really compact cast. And then a bunch of other characters we see on screen, like, they're just voiced by people around Pixar. There's like at least 8 characters that are just voiced by people around Pixar.
That's so fun.
Yeah.
I read that Edna Mode was supposed to be voiced by Lily Tomlin, but she opted out because she liked the voice that Brad Bird was doing so much instead.
Oh, I don't know if I heard it quite in that order, but I did know that Lily Tomlin was supposed to be a part of it. I'm fine with it being Brad Bird because it's ended up being so iconic. And I don't think Lily Tomlin would have been bad at it by any stretch, but the voice Brad Bird does for it is just, it's hilarious.
Yeah. Lily Tomlin would have still sounded like Lily Tomlin no matter what she did with it. And with Brad Bird doing it, it's just like no other character sounds like Edna Mode. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is her name a pun? Like Edna Mode? It's such a weird name, but I can't really tell if it is.
I admit I've never thought about it. Like, it's got to be a reference to somebody because she's supposed to be. I mean, even her design, I think, is a reference to some fashion designer.
Gotcha.
Let's see what we can find out.
It's just such a weird sounding name that like I'm like, this has to evoke something or be a parody of something. I just can't tell what it is.
Mode apparently translates to fashion, but I don't know if there's much more than that.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind. That explains that.
I don't know.
In what language?
German and French, I guess, which seems weird because those languages aren't super related. So it must have come from one into the other, but
sure.
I don't know.
Okay.
I also, that was a quick Google search, so it could be wrong.
Cool. Cool.
Here's a fun fact. Honey, who is Frozone's wife.
Yeah.
I fully expected her to be a voice actress, just even though she only has a few lines, because I was like, she's so good. And the few lines she does have, everybody can quote. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's such a funny sequence.
It's so funny. I think it was even part of the marketing. But she was voiced by a woman named Kimberly Adair Clark, who was a Pixar human resources person.
Whoa.
Right?
She
Isn't that so much
really
fun?
Really good job. Great
yeah,
job.
Yeah. Like, not even an animator or like a storyboarder or somebody who's like typically part of the storytelling process, you know?
Sure.
Or a character designer who might think along the lines of, you know, characterization and stuff. No, it was a human resources person. And my hope, you know, is that they really wanted to make sure that somebody who was maybe not on screen, but obviously like a black woman in the movie was voiced by a black woman in real life. I hope that's why, you know, she's the person they tapped. But yeah, I thought that was so much fun.
I love that.
Yeah.
No, you're right, though. There isn't really a lot of other... The only other character that stuck out to me is Dash's teacher, who I felt really bad for.
Oh, my gosh. Because
he's just being, like, gaslit, essentially. But his head is so weird. Like, everybody...
It's so weird.
Obviously, the whole movie is very stylized. Like, Edna Mode doesn't look like a person, or, you know, but...
No, but all of her doesn't look like a person.
Yeah.
The teacher looks like a person except for his head.
Yeah. And he's like the only one that's really like that. Like, there are weird shaped heads, but not weird shaped in that way in this movie. It's very strange. It just stuck out to me a lot.
like Mr. Incredible has a weird shaped head, but his body is also not proportional to a real human. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or like, or Violet, it has a big head, but it's only because her body is so tiny.
Right.
Yeah, no, he just has an absolutely, completely normal body and the most exaggerated head of anybody in the whole movie. It is so wild.
Yeah, it's so bizarre and off-putting. I love it. It's just weird. I do just generally like how stylized all the character designs are. Like, I almost didn't remember how stylized it was.
Yeah.
But I think, like, I mean, it works for it really well because obviously this is the best that Pixar has ever done with people. There's no question about it.
Oh, yeah.
But
they went all in. Everyone is a human.
Exactly. But they surely weren't to the point where they could, like, do a more photorealistic person. So it was, I think it was really smart for them to sort of split the difference and just go for a very explicit, uber stylized type of people. That's still definitely people, so it's still a huge step in animation, but
huge, because the thing about this movie, you know, we've talked about how every movie to this point has challenged the technical side of computer generated animation to some degree, and obviously with, you know, we talked about Finding Nemo and the checklist of things they had to accomplish to pull that off. This was even more, I think. Like, this was their technically most difficult movie they made, and Brad Bird jokes about how he walked in and made everybody's knees shake at how much he wanted to accomplish, you know, and how there were people saying, like, this should probably be a live-action movie, not animated with CG. You know what I mean? Like, I think you're maybe trying to do too much. And he says, like, and I got almost everything I wanted. And and that's because they're working on human figures that move like humans, even though they're exaggerated. Mm-hmm. Human faces that move like human faces, even though they're exaggerated. They've done fur, but they had to do human hair, and they had to do it wet and in wind and make it look like actual humans as opposed to monsters, where you could get away with a little bit more.
That's something I noticed with the hair. They do such a good job with the hair because the hair is so detailed. Yeah. And it's funny because, like, sometimes it'll just be like a little bit messy. Like, the wet hair looks great. Like, that blew me away, actually.
Their hair looks very, very good. If you haven't paid attention to the hair in this movie, I would recommend paying specific attention to Dash's hair and Helen's hair. I know that Violet's hair is the thing that they're most proud of because the way that it moves is very different and very specific, and they pretty much had to, like, her hair alone was its own problem, and so that's a massive achievement. But I think her hair is very noticeable in its achievement, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times the stuff that you don't notice is the stuff that is most impressive. The detail that goes into Helen's hair in that it's not perfect all the time. And frequently it's just a little bit messy because she's stressed out, you know, but it still moves. Like it's just, it's the human hair in this is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
But the big, big thing, because there was a lot of other stuff. I mean, clothing, they had to do a ton of clothing stuff. Mm-hmm. All the realistic wetness. We saw a little bit of wetness in Finding Nemo, but it's all really brief. And most of that takes place underwater. So they're not actually wet.
Right.
The big thing in this movie was human skin, because there's this thing that human skin does where light permeates it, but obviously doesn't go through it. So like light can penetrate the first few layers of your skin, which is why sometimes it looks like it glows under mm-hmm. certain intensity or from certain directions. Like if you think about a really bright light behind like an ear, or if you put like a laser pointer on your fingernail, you can like see it through your finger.
Mm-hmm.
Light goes through skin. And so they had to figure out, if we're going to have a bunch of human characters that look human, we can't mimic that anymore. We can't pretend that's happening anymore. We have to make sure that we can actually build that into our software so that when we light these characters, it naturally happens, because it would be way too much work to mimic that on every single surface of skin for every single kind of lighting.
Right.
And it works. I mean, if you look at the close-ups of Bob's face, or you look at, you know, actually any close-up of any face, but I think Bob's, it really stands out because he has different textures on his face. You can really tell that there's something more lifelike about his skin or the other character's skin. Actually, even Frozone's skin looks really, really great, which is, I think, really important to note, because he's like the only really, really dark-skinned character on screen.
Yeah.
So they really, I mean, they really accomplished what they set out to do, I think. Compare that to Boo, or compare that to Andy, and it is just, it is worlds of different, you know? It
yeah.
feels way more lifelike and flesh-like than anything else.
That, yep, I couldn't really pinpoint exactly what it was that made them look better, but that makes a lot of sense, that it's just like the light on skin. Huh, yep. I never thought about that. That's
they actually get that glow, you know?
Yeah.
Because it makes their skin not look totally opaque, because skin is not totally opaque.
Right. Which is why so many like lesser animated humans, or ones that came before this, just looked like dolls, essentially. Like they just looked plastic because there wasn't the light penetrating it. Wow.
Exactly.
That's so interesting.
That's why I find computer generated animation so fascinating, because like, You have to basically rebuild the world that you live in virtual space. And I just find that so fascinating. You know what I mean? Because like, we know that skin does that. So how do you make that happen again inside of a computer? Like, I just think it's, I don't know. I get why people find that disenchanting, but I find it incredibly enchanting. I think it's fucking magic. You know what I mean?
It is interesting, because that is a thing that you don't have to do in 2D animation. You can make the skin look flat. You can make a bunch of like flat yellow characters, and no one's going to be like, ooh, Uncanny Valley. Like, you don't have, you just don't have to worry about that. And even with something like Incredibles, which is not trying to be photorealistic at all.
No.
It still needs to get some things right, and some things closer to photorealistic, just because if it didn't, it would just be off-putting and creepy and weird.
Yeah, you'd have a bunch of Woody faces, and Woody looks fine because he's supposed to be made of plastic, but you can't have dozens of characters on screen that look like plastic when they're supposed to be human.
Right.
Just doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, that's all on top of them figuring out how to make superpowers look like superpowers, because you have fire, you have... I actually think I was surprised at how good, for 2004, I'll point out, but still how good it looked for 2004, Frozone's powers look.
Yeah.
I was actually very surprised, because snow is fucking hard. And I think the first time I ever noticed snow really, really looking incredible, like blowing my mind, honestly, was like Frozen. Was when I was like, oh my God, that looks like snow.
Which is like 10 years after this.
I know. But Frozone's actually looks really good for what I was expecting.
Yeah, there's a lot of detail in the snow that they use. And the ice, too. I was surprised at how good the ice... Like, the ice looks realistic. Like, it'd be really easy to do cartoony-looking ice. And I honestly don't think it would have bothered me if they did. But they go for ice that feels really, like, authentic and real. And it looks great.
Yeah. Ah, such a cool movie.
All the... Like, that's the thing is that I was watching it and I was like... A lot of the visuals weren't blowing me away in the way that like Finding Nemo did, because Finding Nemo's visuals are all in the setting, right?
It's yeah, in, like, yeah. The colors, they're like the detail. Spectacular in like a really striking way.
Right. But this one, like I was thinking about that. I was like, yeah, it's not really like blowing me away in that sense. But what does blow me away is every single action sequence looks amazing. the movement is what is so good in this movie. Mm-hmm. And it's like clearly not anything that they could have even attempted to do in movies prior to this. Like it's such a, that's where it feels such a big step up to me is that like these, cause these action sequences are so complicated and involve so many moving parts with these, you know, human characters that they're just now sort of mastering. And it's just like phenomenal how good some of these sequences look.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff that you couldn't do in live action, I don't think, and have it look as good, you know?
No stretchy superpowers have ever looked as good in live action as these do in computer generated animation, because they can do things in animation that don't hit that uncanny valley place that live action does. And I'm sure that we'll figure it out. I mean, honestly, like, computer animation, I think it can do pretty much anything at this point. So like when we get our Fantastic Four, Mr. Fantastic in the MCU, I'm sure he will look incredible. Mm-hmm. But I don't really think it's been done yet.
No, definitely not.
You know?
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
If you do want to, I do think you're right. I think all the action sequences are really incredible, and it's very clear that they focused on those. Like that was a big part of their focus, and a lot of their resources I think went into making sure that action was good. If you do want to know where the age is, I can tell you, skip ahead if you don't want to know where the age is, but we're still in the era of Pixar making sure that you're focusing on the thing they're working the hardest on. Mm-hmm. That's still in this movie. Like we haven't gotten to the point where like even the backgrounds are all mind blowing, right? Like Finding Nemo did that, but Pixar in general isn't quite totally there yet. So I think if you do pay attention to the backgrounds, that's where some of the age is. If you pay attention to like how some of the characters interact with some of the environments, there are some moments where like Dash, and he's a challenging character because he moves so fast. There are some points where like his traction on certain surfaces is a little wonky, but I think they probably get away with it because of the way that he moves. Ultimately, I think it's all because their action is so good that they're like, this is what we need. This is what we're paying attention to. And even still, they make sure that this is a very sort of like retro-futuristic suburb where everything is sort of intentionally flat and blocky anyway.
Yeah.
So even on top of their backgrounds not being incredible, I keep saying incredible, which is a word I say anyway, but it feels weird to say it here.
Nah, lay it on.
But, but you know, knowing that their backgrounds aren't going to be super, super visually stunning, they choose a setting that really works. And I know that's not why they chose the setting, but they certainly take advantage of it.
Oh, yeah.
Because the suburb that they live in is this sort of boring, flat, unremarkable setting on purpose.
Yeah. I love the whole aesthetic of the movie with the retrofuturism kind of art deco.
Yeah.
Style that they go for, the sort of like it's kind of in the 60s, but it's not also not really in any particular time period at the same time. Yep. Like that stuff is so cool, and it's such a cool choice because it's like, I don't know why it feels right for like a superhero movie, but it just, I mean, I guess because like Batman the Animated Series kind of did like art deco retro futurism type stuff sometimes. A lot of art deco actually.
Yeah.
And a lot of like almost like 20s aesthetic sometimes, because I guess because of the noir stuff it was trying to do. But like that's not the only one. Like I feel like the 90s Flash TV show did a lot of like anachronistic type stuff where it would just throw in like art deco type of aesthetic out of nowhere, even though it explicitly took place in the 90s. Like it just sort of works, I guess, maybe because a lot of classic comic books are from between like the 40s through the 60s. Like that's where the whole explosion for all of our modern ones came from. So it's really cool that they sort of like do that as a throwback, but aren't like relying on it at the same time. It's just as a nice backdrop for everything.
Yeah, I think a lot of those styles either fit a particular either optimism or regalness or darkness really, really well, depending on like what you're going for.
Yeah.
And somehow that just like, I think it just works with superheroes because of the overall themes of whatever type of superhero story you're trying to tell. And in this case, that sort of strange suburban 60s retro-futuristic vibe really works for the tone of what they're trying to do.
It almost sort of like highlights them being a nuclear family. Like they're so mm-hmm. normal. They're the type of like family that you would see on TV on a show from the 60s. Like they're just like the Leave It to Beaver family. Like that's, they're just that normal, but then, which is obviously subverted because they're a family of superheroes.
Right. Well, they lay that stuff on thick because they're superheroes. I mean, their last name is literally Parr, which is just like normality. You know what I mean?
Right,
like
right.
Everything about them is a total overcompensation for the fact that they're superheroes.
Right, right.
To the point where it should be suspicious to everyone around them.
It's so fun. Yeah. Yeah. And kind of like in line with the aesthetic, I love the score so much. The like almost like James Bond.
Not
kind of
done
score.
By Randy Newman.
I like Michael Giacchino did it. And I like him as a composer. He's definitely one of my favorite composers. And he's just like, it's so good. It's just the whole movie. Like I think it's just the right vibe for that retro futuristic vibe they're going for. Like it's weird that it feels like a James Bond score, but like it also works for it for the same reason. I don't really know why, but yeah. I dig it. It's great.
Well, anything we haven't gotten to yet that you wanted to be sure we did? I have only one other thing, but I feel like it would be a good ending point.
Sure. I have some like just random notes. There's a lot of great detail in this movie, I think. Like mm-hmm. I like that Bob has like a bald spot. Like it's really subtle, but like it's good. I do. I also like, I like his bizarre body shape. Like even when he's like really heavy, I don't love all the fat jokes, but I know that just like kind of comes with the territory, unfortunately.
So that I don't love it either. And I'm going to say that right at the beginning, but I, in this case specifically, I feel like I understand a bit more how it fits into the character of Bob Parr and what he's going through.
Sure.
As opposed to a lot of other fat jokes in other media.
Yeah.
Because Bob Parr is supposed to be sort of like that, that sort of, that like middle-aged guy that had his golden years in high school and now just sees himself as like a failure through his life and his physical self. You also get to see him confront that, which I think is nice.
Yeah.
I think they probably could have accomplished it without some of the fat jokes, but I think it's also, it is still nice that you get to see a fuller version of that where he's not like reduced to it. So
yeah, sure.
It's, I think you probably could cut out, you probably could cut them out and achieve the same thing, but I understand to a degree how it's supposed to feed into his own view of himself, if that makes any sense.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think you're right. I still think they could have scaled back on it a little bit. Like,
yeah.
I think that the stuff where it is moments where it's just exposing, like, his own confidence in himself and his own self-image, I think that stuff works. But then it's just times when it's just like, well, you're just a random person just commenting on how fat he is for no reason. And, okay, I guess that's funny.
Yeah. those you could totally cut out. Like, Mirage calling him the fat one, you totally could have cut out.
Yeah.
I think you could have cut out, like, the belly shot, as much as I love a belly shot. Like, that is purely meant for us to be like, oh, God.
Yeah.
I think you could have – I think if you were going to – if I were to keep one to specifically feed into Bob's own – mentality and view of himself, it would be only the one where he doesn't fit and that like into the thing, whatever that thing is, because it's in front of somebody else and he's obviously bothered by that.
Sure.
But I think you probably could get rid of every other one.
Sure.
And you'd get just enough of the like Bob being very obviously embarrassed and using that as a motivation for himself, for his own goals, not for anybody else's.
Yeah.
Without any of the like, isn't it funny that he's fat?
Right. And I like that, like, even when he gets in shape, he's still, like, not in the same shape that he was in the flashback. Like, he's still, like, a hefty
guy. Oh, that's such a good detail.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a good detail. Like, he's not the same shape. He's still an older guy and a bigger body type than he was before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like Helen is, like, a bigger, more adult version of herself from the beginning of the movie.
Right. And it's, like, it's – and it doesn't – inhibit, you know, for Bob at first, because he's obviously really rusty, it like inhibits him a little bit. And I love the bit when he like throws out his back, but then like the robot like stretching him out cracks his back. It's oh my God, that's so real.
Can I get one of those robots? Good Lord.
Right. But I love that like outside of that, once he's over that initial hump, like even when he's still out of shape, and Helen too, who also is out of practice, like they still kick ass. Like just because just being like quote unquote out of shape doesn't mean that you can't be a fucking badass, you know?
Right.
They just don't have the same body type that they did when they were 20, you know?
Right. Despite Bob being like a wide shouldered, like strongman type, he and Helen do have different body types than you would typically see like a comic book superhero having. And part of it is because their features are so exaggerated. So like Helen is still a very curvaceous woman, but most of her curves are in her hips, signifying the fact that like she's had some kids, right? Yeah. It's not that she's like a massively boobed, tiny waisted, like no butt, like superhero with barely any clothing. You know, like that's not what they're going for when they make her curvaceous.
Right. Right.
Does have a tiny waist, and I'm sure some people don't love that, and I get it, but they're all such caricatures.
It's like I get her design. It's like, it's a little weird, and I could see how people would be opposed to that.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my notes is just the phrase Mr. Incredible in a tank top, and that's it. That's all I have to say about that.
Is that before or after his weight loss?
It's like during, it's like in the process of it.
Is it when he's like working? It's part of his workout montage.
Yeah, when he's like lifting trains and stuff.
I love when he's lifting trains. It's not even a big deal, but I just think it's so fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that's so fun to me, but it is.
It's the kind of thing that like it makes a lot of sense and is almost surprising that it hasn't really been done in live action. I feel like, you know, like, but
there's
maybe
somebody. Who is it? There's some superhero that worked out with trains.
But like the way that Mr. Incredible does it is in such a fun, comical way that Superman still could do, you know, like, it's not out of the bounds of some of the super strength superheroes to be able to do that. And it's also just really pretty. Like the sunlight is really good in that, in that sequence.
It's a well-lit shot. And it's funny too, because then he tries to like play it off like it wasn't doing anything.
Yeah. It's all good. This is super, super minor, but I really love the subtlety of in the prologue when we see Incrediboy, they do like a close-up on his face, and you see behind his domino mask that he's clearly covered in, he's clearly colored in with a marker around his eyes, like that kind of dark space, which is one of those things that like most superhero movies just don't acknowledge, that if you're wearing a domino mask, like there's gonna be some kind of paint and makeup around it, and like they just sort of like they peel off the mask and there's no makeup on it.
Movie does that, like there's they make a specific point to ensure that his homemade domino mask isn't fitted to his face properly, so he needs that makeup.
Right. So it's funny that like with Incrediboy, what was his name? Buddy? Yeah, Buddy, right? They like actually like kind of make that very clear just to show how homemade everything is. It's just fun because like that's a thing that it took me a very long time to notice, that it's just like, oh yeah, they are wearing makeup under those masks. Like they just, you just don't pick up on that. Oh, and I think this is one of like a more well-known ones, but the bit with with Helen / I feel weird calling her Elastigirl. I don't like any time this like an adult woman is called girl, but I guess she's canonically Elastigirl, right?
Yeah, her superhero name is Elastigirl. You could call her Mrs. Incredible. It's like an alternate name, but like that's not really super official, and it also is like a weird. It's like a weird thing because it's like, well, wait, so like you changed your superhero name because you married Mr. Incredible, but nobody knows you're married to Mr. Incredible. Yeah. So why would we? Why would we call you that? I mean, like, officially, she's Elastigirl, yeah.
Like, I get it. It's like, that's a very comic booky thing, right? Like, I get it.
Yeah.
It still is just like, I feel like I have too much respect for Helen to call her girl, but whatever. Yeah. When Helen is stuck between, like, four different doors in the complex, it's so good. Oh, my God, it's so funny. It goes on for so long, too. Like, fantastic. Yes. I love it.
They do such, I know we've already said this, but they do such a good job with her flexibility and her stretching powers.
Yeah, love it. Such a good sequence. Everything else is just like really fun details in it. I love Dash eating the steak without cutting it. Really funny. the sprinklers going off in their house is such a nightmare because my apartment has sprinklers.
Oh my God.
And I just think about, I mean, supposedly they will only go off if there is actually like flames like hitting them, which is good. Theoretically that will never happen. But like, that just terrifies me because my life would be ruined if they just went off for a few minutes, you know? So that's a nightmare. I made a note of this because like, is it, are those two like old guys that are like, yeah, this is like real old school, like during the last sequence, are they like a reference or like cameos from anybody? Because I feel like there's like a weird amount of time spent on them with like a, with very distinct voices commenting on how the superheroes are doing it old school and old school rules, that like it felt like they were meaningful, but I didn't know if they were or not.
I felt the same way, but I am not currently aware of that. But I have to admit, I've also never looked into it.
Gotcha.
So if they are, I just am not, I'm not sure. Yeah. But I wouldn't be surprised to find that out, because I agree with you. Like, it felt like a very specific shot.
Yeah, that was the list of random stuff. It's such a fun movie. There's so much stuff in it. I really did enjoy it a lot. And I do think that, like, I think all the conversation and discourse that has been around it for the past 10, 15 years, like, I think it's all really interesting. And I think it's all really valid, too, because it's just, I think it's a testament to how fascinating this movie is that there's just so much to unpack in it, depending on where you're at in life and where you're coming from. It's a really good movie.
Yeah. A lot of people will still list it as their favorite Pixar movie. Like, that is not an uncommon opinion.
I wouldn't disagree with that. Like, I think it's definitely a top tier one for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think back when Inside Out came out, I think I definitely had it in like somewhere in my top like 5 to 7. I don't remember what I did, but at one point I ranked Pixar movies, and I'm not interested in pulling it out, so don't ask anybody. So my last thing is just, you know that there is another Incredibles movie, but you haven't seen it, right?
No, the only thing I know about it, because I probably saw a trailer when it came out or whatever, I know that it has something to do with Helen leaving, and then Bob is like, I'm a dad who has to deal with kids. Oh no. That's the extent that I know about it.
So I guess the only thing I am curious about is, like, having seen this Incredibles movie and seeing what it does, what do you want to see, or what would you expect to see from more Incredibles? Because that sequel came out like 11 or 12 years later.
Yeah. I want to see, I think that I expect to see more from Helen, if only because culture has changed so much where it's like, yeah, we should put more focus on women in movies, especially in superhero media. So I expect Helen to have a larger role. Not that she didn't have a large role in this one, but as we talked about, like, we don't get a lot of her perspective. She's definitely sort of like secondary to Bob as the main character. And yeah. I would expect the second one to split the perspective more equally between the two of them, rather than it being just Bob's story. And I don't think that the movie is just going to be about, like, I'm a dad and aren't kids crazy? Like, I just don't think that would make sense for a Pixar movie made in 2018 or whenever it was made.
Sure.
So I expect that's a jumping off point that they're going to, like, actually have interesting things to say about. But yeah, other than that, I really don't know. I hope we get more of Violet. I expect Dash's voice actor to get recast, because I'm sure that voice actor was a kid, right? So.
Oh yeah, I mean, I can just tell you right off the bat, like, they recast Dash there's not a significant. I don't even know if you know this, but there's not a significant time jump in the next movie.
I did know that, because I know Jack is still a baby, so like, and I'm sure they'll do plenty of stuff with that. Like, that was one thing. I mean, we didn't really talk about Jack at all. Not that there's much to talk about. I do think it's like fun that his power is just this chaotic, like, shape shifting elemental shape shifting ability.
I was legitimately gagged in the theater, one, when they get home and Syndrome is there with Jack. That was a legitimate, like, oh my God moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I don't know. I just remember being like, oh, that's right. Like, they never really tied up that part.
Yeah. Because they do such a good job framing, like, what comes before that. It's just such a triumphant, like, climactic ending to the movie that you do almost forget that, like, Syndrome hasn't been defeated yet.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, yeah. Well, because they kind of, like, throw him to the side, and you could get away with being like, and he kind of sucked all along.
Right.
But luckily they don't do that. But then also I remember There was definitely an energy about the theater when Jack-Jack's power started manifesting. And with each one that happened, that energy just got, like, bigger and bigger until everybody was just sort of like, ah!
It's great. Because at first it's like, oh, okay, he's just the Human Torch. That's fun because they're all kind of Fantastic Four characters. Oh, wait, there's more to this. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah,
Jack-Jack,
I love that.
Also a very valuable character in LEGO's The Incredibles video game.
Nice.
Very handy character to use.
That's so fun. Yeah, I'm excited to see what they do with that in the sequel. Because, I mean, that's obviously fun. Comical shenanigans come from an infant with superpowers. So, like,
yeah,
that's going to be fun. That's another thing I did like about the movie, too, is that it's a really minor thing. But I think I was almost surprised that, like, with Jack-Jack, he just matter-of-factly thought that he didn't have superpowers, and there wasn't any, like, weird angst, like, oh, no, I have a kid who won't have superpowers. This is so sad. Like, that's a thing that they do, like, in Sky High and, like, in Up, Up, and Away. And the fact that it's just, like, oh, yeah, he's just our kid. He doesn't have superpowers, whatever. Like, I like that. That also is another thing that sort of counters any of, like, the weird, like, biological superiority conversations that have it, because it's, like, they have a kid who isn't a super and they're fine with it. Like, nobody cares.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think we covered a lot. I think we got into it.
This is one of those movies that you can really talk for like 4 hours on, I think.
Oh yeah.
There's just so much in it and so many.
Yeah.
Complicated themes and everything, so.
For sure. And I'm sure we'll revisit some of it when we get into The Incredibles 2 as well.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
Yeah, because I'm sure we'll both rewatch Incredibles before that.
Yep.
At least I will.
I think I would
sure
want
you
to,
will
too. Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening. If you're here listening to this lovely episode on The Incredibles, if you are here for the first time, you can go back and listen to our 5 episodes before this covering all the movies of Pixar's chronology before The Incredibles. And, next month we'll be covering the next one. But in the meantime, Derek, if people want to find what you are doing and the things you're working on, where can they do that?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Derek B. Gale. You can also find me on my YouTube channel, Second Chance, which is a video essay series that looks at bad or divisive media, but from a positive lens. What about you, Doug?
You can find me on Twitter at IckyBooley, IckyBooley. You can also find me on another podcast called Victory Road, a Pokemon podcast over on the Four-Eyed Radio Network, where my co-host Kyle and I talk about Pokemon just as we feel like it. And if you like books and video games, you can find me on another podcast called Novel Gaming, which is a podcast about books and video games with splashes of other pop culture. If you would like more from me and Derek, you can find everything we are doing on our website at wallopingwebsnappers.com, where we have all of our episodes of this show, but also our show Walloping Web Snappers, which is a deep dive into every Spider-Man cartoon ever made. All of our podcasts are archived by series or by movies like this one. So it's very easy to find what you are looking for. If you like what we are doing, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Google Play Music or wherever you listen to your podcasts, because it helps other people find us. And if you like what we are doing, someone else will too. Next month, we'll be back with a movie. I think the first movie Derek hasn't seen at all, right?
Nope. I know nothing about it other than just the basic premise, which is that there are cars. That's all
that
I know.
There are cars. That there are talking cars in the movie Cars. So get excited for that one. I personally can't wait to find out where our conversation goes. So we will see you then.
See ya.